media buyers that they were offered money on Wednesday to actually test one of our new ads, and that's when we found out we were shut down. And so it had nothing to do with money. We're well within our credit limits there. And so, like I said before, I believe it's because we brought Lou Dobbs over to Lindell TV. And
yeah, there really isn't evidence for that. My Pillow, Mike Lindell, says that it is not because he stopped paying Fox News. What is the truth? With Pillow, you never know. I don't know if you noticed, but he slipped in there that he supports our real president, Donald Trump. Really couldn't happen to a nicer guy. And as I've said before, this entire getting involved with politics thing has been the worst thing for the MyPillow brand. Mike Pillow personally is very wealthy, but those 1,500 employees of his, it's a different story. And anecdotally, we know that many of them are not thrilled with this holy war that he seems to be waging in the political space. We will follow what happens to MyPillow. We've got a great bonus show for you today. I will be joined by producer Pat. We will talk about strange reactions to MLK Day yesterday, AI's influence on jobs, and so many more things. Sign up at joinpacman.com to There is a new report out with allegations from a top European Union official that Donald Trump at one point vowed never to help Europe if Europe were attacked. And I, in being super honest, after the way Trump dealt with Putin in Helsinki, this doesn't come as the biggest surprise, but it is news nonetheless. This is a report from Politico. Trump vowed he'd never help Europe if it's attacked, top EU official says. By the way, NATO is dead, the former and potential future U.S. president added. This is from an alleged private meeting. What does it say? One of Europe's most senior politicians recounted how former U.S. President Donald Trump privately warned that America would not come to the EU's aid if it was attacked militarily. Trump told European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in 2020. This is according to the French European Commissioner Thierry Breton, who was present at the meeting at the World Economic Forum in Davos. Quote, you need to understand that if Europe is under attack, we will never come to help you and to support you. By the way, NATO is dead and we will leave. We will quit NATO. And he added, and by the way, you owe me $400 billion because you didn't pay, you Germans, what you had to pay for defense. It was described as a tense meeting at which the EU's then trade chief, Phil Hogan, was present. This anecdote was recounted at an event in European Parliament in Brussels on Tuesday. So let's talk about a few of the different elements here. First of all, if I'm super honest with you, when Trump and Putin did that kind of press, that public event in Helsinki, and Trump just sucked up to Putin and said, listen, I asked Putin, did you hack in the 2016 election? And Putin denied it very strongly. And I believe him. It was very clear at that point that there were questions as to Trump's commitment to our NATO responsibilities, to Trump's commitment to defense of Europe and all of it. Now, I want to go a little bit further because there's the question that is a legitimate question, which is, should the U.S. come to Europe's defense? Why is it the default that the U.S. come to Europe's defense? There's no rule that says the United States must be allied with Europe, mostly Western Europe. There's no rule that says the United States has to come to the defense unless there is such an agreement in place that says that. And this is really the problem with people like Trump. We saw this with the Iran nuclear deal where Trump was just like, I'm out. I just don't like it. Iran hadn't violated it, but Trump just said, I don't like it. I'm getting out. And there are other examples of the same sort of thing. In order to be taken seriously, we're only as good as our word. And if we become the sort of country where there is a year of negotiation under one president and an agreement is signed, and then the next president just goes, I don't like it, I'm out, that's the Iran deal, that makes us look bad. When it is something as significant as NATO and shared defense of our European allies, you can argue it's not in American interests to come to the defense of Western Europe. I'm not making that argument. I'm just saying one could argue that. And then you could say there should be a renegotiation of the shared defense commitments. Maybe NATO is dead in the sense that the U.S. should or could get out. You can do those things, and they need to be done diplomatically and correctly.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Hard as it may seem, given that the war on terror has stretched for over 20 years, but this might be the most dangerous moment I've ever observed in the Middle East. Whether it's the United States or Iran and each of their various allies, the escalatory pressures of the current war emerging from Israel's devastation of Gaza are tremendous.
From Iraq to Lebanon to Pakistan to the Red Sea, can Israel's war on Gaza escalate into a full-blown regional conflict? We'll speak with award-winning journalist Spencer Ackerman. But first, Gaza's the deadliest place for journalists on record.
More journalists have been killed in Israel's assault on Gaza, nearly all of them Palestinian, than have ever been killed in a single country over an entire year. Many of those journalists who are still alive have lost their family members, have lost their homes. So this really is a war on journalists in Gaza.
We'll speak with independent journalist Sharif Abdelkadous and Sharif Mansour with the Committee to Protect Journalists. We'll take an in-depth look at a new investigation into the killing of an Al Jazeera cameraman last month. And what do Israelis see on TV? How has Israeli media's coverage shaped opinions of the war? We'll go to Tel Aviv to speak with Haaretz journalist Gideon Levy. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Pakistan has condemned Iran for violating its airspace and killing two children in air attacks less than a day after Iranian attacks in Iraqi Kurdistan killed at least four people. Iranian media said two bases of the Jaish al-Adl militants in Balochistan were destroyed late Tuesday, though there has been no official confirmation from Tehran of its responsibility. Pakistan recalled its ambassador from Iran and said the Iranian ambassador to Pakistan would be barred from returning. This comes amidst escalating tensions that are spreading throughout the Middle East. The U.S. carried out its third strike against Yemen's Houthi forces Tuesday. The White House also announced it's redesignating the Houthi militia as a terrorist group and reimposing penalties on the Iran-backed group in retaliation for their attacks in the Red Sea, which have led to no casualties but have disrupted global trade. The group's vowed to continue its campaign in the Red Sea as long as Israel continues to attack Gaza. On Tuesday, a Greek vessel headed to Israel was hit by a Houthi missile. We'll have more on the possibility of a wider conflict later in the broadcast. In Gaza, displaced civilians are again fleeing as intense Israeli bombardment rains down on Khan Yunis, including the area around its main hospital, Al-Nasser. Israeli ground forces have also been reported in the area. Overnight, Palestinian journalist Bissan Alda was able to post a video from the hospital despite a five-day-long communications blackout. Bissan Alda said she feared it could be her final update.
The medical staff, the ambulances, many people also evacuated the hospital, and that's so dangerous. This is the last functioning hospital in Gaza. That means that thousands of injuries are still now alone in the hospital. Displaced people are alone in the hospital. They are besieged. We are besieged. I don't know if I can survive this or go anywhere. I'm just alone. Alone as thousands, alone as many in other hospitals were before.
Bissan Alda did survive the night and called on her followers to observe a global strike against the war next week. Qatar and France have brokered a deal for medicine to enter Gaza for the remaining Israeli hostages in exchange for aid for Palestinians. This comes amidst a worsening humanitarian catastrophe as a UN rights expert asserted, quote, every single person in Gaza is hungry. The death toll has topped 24,000. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia's foreign minister said Tuesday Saudi Arabia could recognize Israel if the conflict's resolved and includes Palestinian statehood. Israel's deadly attacks in the occupied West Bank continue, with at least 7 Palestinians killed over the past day. On Tuesday, mourners attended the funeral of 21-year-old Ahad Mohammed in Dura, near the West Bank city of Hebron, after she was killed during an Israeli raid Monday. This is her sister.
Ahed was martyred here on the rooftop of her parents-in-law's house, where there was supposed to be a wedding next Friday. In our tradition, people come to arrange stuff for the bride. This is why Ahed was here. Ahed has a 6-month-old daughter. Her name is Ayul. She left Ayul behind. She left her to be a daughter of a martyr with no memories with her mother because they didn't have the chance to make memories together.
The Palestinian Health Ministry says Israeli forces have killed some 350 West Bank Palestinians since October 7th. In addition, at least 94 houses have been destroyed across the occupied territory, displacing 602 Palestinians, including 263 children, since October 7th. That's according to the United Nations. On Monday, an elderly Israeli woman was killed and 17 people injured, including children, after a ramming and stabbing attack in the central Israeli city of Ra'anana. A Palestinian man and his nephew have been detained as suspects. Here in the United States, senators voted against a resolution advanced by Senator Bernie Sanders Tuesday that would have required the Biden administration to provide Congress with a report on how U.S. arms are being used in Israel and its human rights violations in Palestine. Just 11 senators backed Sanders' measure. Of the 11 backers, only 3 have called for a ceasefire in Gaza: Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, Peter Welch, and Jeff Merkley. Dick Durbin is the 4th U.S. senator to call for a ceasefire. Ben & Jerry's ice cream has joined calls for an immediate and permanent ceasefire in Gaza. Ben & Jerry's board chair, Anuradha Mittal, said in an interview with the Financial Times the ice cream company has long stood by the principle of peace. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, some 130 Mennonite protesters were arrested Tuesday during a peaceful sit-in in the Cannon House office building. Demonstrators sang hymns and chanted, "Let Gaza live." Meanwhile, in the latest crackdown by U.S. colleges on Palestinian voices, Indiana University canceled the first U.S. retrospective of renowned artist Samia Halabi. Halabi, who is an Indiana University alum, was informed her social media posts on the Israeli assault expressing solidarity with Gazans under attack was the reason for the cancellation. The exhibition had been in the works for over 3 years. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott is facing more condemnation for his support of anti-immigrant and border enforcement policies that led to the recent deaths of another 3 asylum seekers attempting to cross the Rio Grande near the border city of Eagle Pass. The mother and her 2 young children have been identified as 33-year-old Victorina de la Sancha Cerros, Yorlai Ruby, and Jonathan Augustine Briones de la Sancha, who were 10 and 8 years old. They were from Mexico. Their drowning Friday came just days after Texas troopers took over about 2.5 miles of the U.S.-Mexico border, including Shelby Park near Eagle Pass, a city park on the banks of the Rio Grande, denying access to U.S. Border Patrol attempting to respond to rescue calls. The area has also been blocked off with fencing, gates and razor wire. The Biden administration has given Governor Abbott until today to remove the barriers after the Justice Department Friday petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to intervene against Texas. Texas Congressmember Joaquin Castro said, quote, "This is what Operation Lone Star looks like on the ground. Texas officials block Border Patrol agents from doing their job and allow 2 children to drown in the Rio Grande. Governor Abbott's inhumanity has no limit. Everyone who enables his cruelty has blood on their hands," Castro said. Bipartisan Congress members agreed to a $78 billion short-term funding bill that would avert a partial government shutdown Friday while expanding the child tax credit and restoring business tax breaks, among other things. The deal was put forward by Democratic Senator Ron Wyden, chair of the Senate Finance Committee, and Republican Jason Smith, chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. But it's not clear if the measure can garner enough support to pass. Some Democrats say the child tax credit doesn't go far enough and are pushing for the same deal as during the pandemic-era American Rescue Plan. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities forecasts the plan would lift some 400,000 children out of poverty in its first year. Meanwhile, President Biden's expected to meet with congressional leaders at the White House today amidst deadlocked talks over his request for $100 billion in supplemental funding for Ukraine and Israel's military and Taiwan, which Republicans have insisted be tied to further militarizing the U.S.-Mexico border. The UN's Human Rights Office is calling on Alabama to halt its first planned execution of a prisoner using nitrogen gas asphyxiation later this month.
We have serious concerns that Smith's execution in these circumstances could breach the prohibition on torture or other cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, as well as his right to effective remedies. These are rights that are set out in two international human rights treaties that the U.S. is bound by.
Kenneth Eugene Smith is scheduled to be executed next Thursday, January 25th, after losing his appeal at the Alabama Supreme Court. In November 2022, prison officials called off another execution attempt against Smith after they were unable to establish an IV line for his lethal injection. Smith's lawyers argued subjecting him to a second execution attempt constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. In D.C., the Capitol Police and FBI are investigating statements attributed to longtime Trump associate Roger Stone, who reportedly said two top Democratic lawmakers and Trump critics have to die weeks before the 2020 election. The website Mediaite reports the comments targeting Congressmembers Eric Swalwell and Jerry Nadler were made to Stone associate Salvatore Greco, a former New York City policeman, and posted audio of the encounter.
Either Swalwell or Nadler has to die before the election. They need to get the message.
Either Swalwell or Nadler has to die before the election. They need to get the message, says the recording. Mediaite reports an unnamed source believes Stone was, quote, not joking around. Roger Stone has dismissed the reports and the recording as AI manipulation. And as world leaders are gathering in Davos, Switzerland, for the World Economic Forum, Oxfam issued a new report showing the world's five richest billionaires have seen their wealth double over the past 4 years, while 5 billion others have become poorer. Oxfam is predicting the world could have its first trillionaire in a decade. Oxfam's interim executive director, Amitabh Bihar, spoke in Davos.
I certainly feel angry. You know, I would say having billionaires is a failure. Very often when we are here at the World Economic Forum, you end up celebrating billionaires. But I think it's a sign of failure that we have 800 million people, 10% of the global population, sleeping hungry. They do not have enough food to eat. 800 million people. And on the other hand, you have these billionaires with their private yachts, private jets, and a lifestyle which cannot even be understood.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. It's freezing cold here, Juan, in New York. How about Chicago?
Yeah, even colder here, Amy. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, Israel's bombardment of Gaza from the land, air and sea continued today. Much of it in the southern part of the territory, in the cities of Khan Yunis and Rafah. At least 163 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza in the last 24 hours, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Some of the worst shelling hit the western side of Khan Yunis, which was designated in the early stages of Israel's assault on Gaza as a so-called safe zone by Israel. There's also been intense Israeli bombardment in the vicinity of Nasser Hospital, the main hospital in the city, and tanks and armored vehicles are on the main road leading to the area. Among the places hit in Khan Yunis was a school sheltering displaced Palestinians. An eyewitness described the attack.
We saw death with all colors. The tanks entered. We saw everything vividly. It was horrible. Random shelling, random fire, random killing. They are coming just to kill and go back home. This is a Nakba. They are just coming to kill children, women, elderly, in the bathroom, in the school, in the hospital, in the street, anywhere. They killed us. They are just coming to kill only. Just that. Just killing.
The interruption of communications and internet services in Gaza for days has continued for the fifth consecutive day, the longest telecommunications blackout of the war so far. This has caused delays for emergency workers to respond to airstrikes and has hampered media coverage from Palestinian journalists in Gaza. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera's bureau chief, Wael al-Dadu, left Gaza on Tuesday, crossing into Egypt and flying to Qatar to receive medical treatment. Dadu has come to symbolize both the suffering and resilience of Palestinian journalists in Gaza. In October, four members of his family were killed, including his wife, his 15-year-old son, his 7-year-old daughter, and his grandson, in an Israeli strike on a refugee camp where they were seeking shelter after their home was bombed. Last week, his eldest son, 27-year-old Hamza, also a journalist, was killed, along with another journalist in an Israeli airstrike on their car in Khan Yunis. Dadu will receive medical treatment in Doha for a wound he received when Israel bombed the area he was in that ended up killing his camera person, Samer Abu Dhaka. By some counts, over 110 journalists have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. The Committee to Protect Journalists has found more journalists have been killed in the first 10 weeks of Israel's war on Gaza than have ever been killed in a single country over an entire year. For more, we're joined by two guests. Sherif Abdelkaddous is an independent journalist and a Democracy Now! Correspondent. His latest piece for The Intercept investigates the killing of Abu Dhaka. It's headlined, "Israel bombed an Al Jazeera cameraman and blocked evacuation efforts as he bled to death." He's joining us from here in New York. In Washington, D.C., we're joined by Sherif Mansour, the Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Before we talk to Sherif about the cameraman, the Al Jazeera cameraman, who bled to death over 5 hours, can we put this in a broader context, Sherif Mansour? Talk about the astounding number, the horrific number of journalists who have died in Gaza.
Well, thank you for having me again, Amy. I've already talked to you about this at least twice, and the number only goes higher. The deadly pattern we discuss become more deadly. And we have since talked about the apparent pattern of targeting, again, journalists, their families, and specifically when we discuss Al Jazeera and Al Dahdouh's family, there really are rewriting what it means to be a journalist today with immense, brave, and never seen before sacrifices. The Palestinian journalists, local journalists so far, 76 out of 83 we've counted since the start of the war are Palestinians. The overwhelming majority are killed by the Israeli army. The Israeli army has killed more journalists in the span of those 3 months than any other entity or army have done over a course of 1 year since 1992. This is the most dangerous and the we've never seen any assignment like this before. Of course, what we called on is independent and transparent and thorough investigation. We want to see the case of Al Dahdouh, his son, Al Jazeera, and others that show culpability of the Israeli army to be put to public scrutiny by allowing immediate entry to international media and international investigators into Gaza without censorship by the Israeli army. The killing must stop, and for that to happen, the record must be made public, and U.S., European, and other allies of Israel need to call Israel on that record and ensure those investigations are made immediately public.
And Sharif Mansour, what has been the response of the Israeli government and the Israeli Defense Forces, given the enormous number of journalists killed? Have they accepted any culpability at all for any of these killings?
The cases of precise attacks by drones against Al Jazeera, which happened at least twice in the last 4 weeks, included for the first time the Israeli army taking responsibility of doing those attacks, but also doing as they done in the past when they are held responsible, because the case of a journalist is someone who was behind an international news organization. They said they will investigate, but they also push false narratives, claims that they are terrorists or that they were part of an ongoing crossfire. And as we've seen in past incidents before this war, this time around, three narratives pushed by the Israeli army, correcting and changing and providing nothing more than a questionable document with English for the first time, coming from what they said was a terrorist group, but providing no other evidence that support their claim. And have so far, the outlets, eyewitnesses, and the families of the journalists have denied the Israeli army narratives and showed to the contrary that, for example, Hamza, an Al Jazeera journalist, was approved to travel before his father, Wael Dahdouh, did yesterday after Israel vetted him. And if he was wanted by any chance, he wouldn't have had this approval before he was killed. And all our testimony and accounts that we and others are showing the contradicting nature of these narratives. This is also the same narrative we said happened before this war started in our deadly pattern report. And it is a pattern of responses designed to evade responsibilities by throwing the word terrorists, by also pushing out those narratives until the world look away.
And Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International are both calling for Israel to be officially investigated for war crimes and its targeting of journalists, not only in Gaza, but outside of Gaza, because an internal Reuters investigation found that one of its journalists, Issam Abdallah, was killed by an Israeli tank shell fired on him and a group of six other journalists in southern Lebanon on October 13th. Could you talk about these attacks outside of Gaza?
So we saw the same pattern of disregard for press insignia that we reported before this war. 13 out of 20 journalists killed by IDF fire over 21 years were press signs and press insignias showing that they are media personnel. And like those cases, the case of Issam Abdallah show with independent investigation, physical proof, forensic proof from the scene, in addition to mapping, audio and visual analysis by international human rights groups and international media organizations that show that those journalists did not pose any threat to Israeli government positions, that they have been seen by an Israeli drone at least an hour, that they were visibly expressing or showing press signs and on laser cameras, and the position that they have taken was a high vantage hill that did not obscure their location with being close to any camera or house that justify that they would have any threat. And all of these and other evidence have shown that what we show in the past, in the cases of at least three journalists that we categorized as murder before this course, including Shireen Abu Aqla and Yasser Murtaja and Mahmoud Abu Hussein, who were killed in Gaza, that there was no justification for the use of lethal force by the Israeli army. And those and other cases are much that we call for independent investigation as war crimes, because the Israeli army did not live up to their commitments and obligation under international law.
And, of course, Shireen Abu Aqla was killed May 11, 2022, outside the Jenin refugee camp. Sharif Abdelkaddous did a George Polk Award-winning documentary on the killing of Shireen Abu Aqla. He's joining us as well. But, Sharif, I wanted to ask you about this latest piece you did for The Intercept that's headlined, "Israel Bombed an Al Jazeera Cameraman and Blocked Evacuation Efforts as He Bled to Death." Give us the TikTok, the chronology on what happened on that horrific day when he and Wael Al-Dadou, who is the Gaza bureau chief for Al Jazeera, went to the school that was bombed. Tell us exactly what happened.
Right, Amy. And when we talk about the killing of Palestinian journalists in Gaza, this was an incident on December 15th where much of the world watched as hours ticked by as Samer Abu Daa was wounded and prevented from getting medical care by Israel and eventually died. And so that timeline of what happened, I think, is extremely important. But basically, Wael Al-Dahdouh, who is Al Jazeera's bureau chief in Gaza, went with Samer Abu Daa, who's a 20-year veteran journalist, a cameraman. They went to this school in Khan Yunis, which had been bombed earlier in the day. And they were accompanied by a team of civil defense workers. That team had received, had requested and received approval by the Israeli military through the Red Cross to be in the area. They got there around noon. They spent about 2.5 hours in the area. This is according to Wael Al-Dahdouh. And as they were wrapping up their coverage, he said there were hardly anyone in the area. There were drones buzzing overhead. They were just about to leave and go back to the ambulance that had brought them there when a strike hit them at about 2:30 p.m. Wael Al-Dahdouh was thrown to the ground. He said he, when he got up and kind of regained awareness, he realized he was bleeding quite profusely from his arm and that he would bleed to death if he didn't get medical attention. He looked over and saw the three civil defense workers who were accompanying them had been killed instantly. And then at a small distance away, he saw his colleague, Samer Abu Daa, on the ground. He had been wounded in the lower part of his body. Wael said that he seemed like he was screaming. Wael, at that point, had lost much of his hearing from the blast, and that Samer couldn't get up. Wael realized the only chance that both of them had was for him to get to medical attention and get help to bring Samer out, because he couldn't get up. So Wael somehow stumbled across about 800 meters to the ambulance that was waiting. He begged them to go in and get Samer, but they insisted on evacuating him first to a hospital in Khan Yunis and that another ambulance would go retrieve him. There are videos of Wael Al-Dahdouh receiving treatment, wincing in pain, calling on people to go get Samer, telling them to coordinate with the Red Cross. What we understand from Wael and others is that an ambulance did go immediately to try and retrieve Samer from the area, but that they were fired on or in their area, in their proximity, by Israeli forces. At the same time, Al Jazeera's bureau chief in Ramallah, Walid Al-Omari, was making calls to the Red Cross. This is around 3:30 p.m. and asking the Red Cross to liaise with the Israeli military to allow four emergency crews to reach Samer Abu Daa and Khan Yunis. So the Israeli military knew, at least by 3 or 3:30, that there was a wounded journalist who lay helpless that needed evacuation. And at the same time, news was spreading of Samer Abu Daa's plight. And a group called the Foreign Press Association, which is a Jerusalem-based nonprofit representing reporters, mostly foreign reporters from over 30 countries. And there's a WhatsApp group which has about 140 of these journalists on it. One of the journalists, a freelance reporter and producer based in Jerusalem named Orly Halpern, posted just after 3 p.m. About Samer's plight and told the journalists or called on them to call Israeli military spokespeople and to demand that Samer be evacuated. And so the FPA was getting involved. Senior members of the FPA, the Foreign Press Association were getting involved, calling Israeli military officials, Israeli military spokespeople, senior ones, repeatedly asking for passage for Semer. And from what we understand, at The Intercept, we obtained screenshots of this WhatsApp group from multiple journalists in the group, and also from speaking with people involved in these efforts, that for hours, Israel did not give approval to these ambulances. Finally, after about 5 hours after Semer was initially wounded, a bulldozer was finally approved to go through to reach Semer. But by then, he had already died. He had bled out. He was found with—he seemed to have removed his flak jacket and had tried to crawl and had died. And it was incredibly tragic. He had lain there. Al Jazeera had posted a live counter of the hours and minutes since he was wounded on its broadcast, and people were just watching, and he eventually died. And the next day, Jazeera announced it was preparing a legal file to submit to the International Criminal Court over what it called the assassination of Semer Abu Daa. And so did Reporters Without Borders also included his killing in a filing with the ICC, war crimes against journalists killed in Gaza. So, you know, the world should be outraged about this killing, about all the killings that are happening to Palestinians, Palestinian journalists in Gaza.
So, Sharif, in this particular case, there is no doubt that the highest echelons of the Israeli Defense Forces were aware that this journalist was wounded and in need of medical attention.
Yes, we have multiple journalists who told—we have screenshots of a WhatsApp group where they're discussing having spoken to Israeli military spokespeople in those hours and saying no approval yet, ambulances not cleared, a bulldozer is not cleared yet. So this took hours. And, you know, the Israeli military must have known very early on what the situation is. They're the ones who had repeatedly bombed the area. They knew there was rubble in the streets. There's constant, near-constant drone surveillance of Gaza. The Red Cross, we know, was liaising with the Israeli military to try and get approval. And yet they left, or they just didn't allow, by some accounts, firstly, ambulances were fired on that tried to reach Semer Abu Daa. They returned back. This is the Palestinian Red Crescent and civil defense. And they were waiting then for approval. They also asked for Red Cross teams to accompany them to the area as a form of protection. And all of this is happening while Semer Abu Daa is lying helpless. The Israeli military is not giving permission, and he eventually died.
And then, again, that was Wael Al-Dadu's camera person and dear colleague, who bleeds to death over 5 hours. And then, in the last weeks, his son, Hamza Al-Dadu, also an Al Jazeera journalist, is killed in this Israeli airstrike, along with the AFP stringer, Mustafa Thoraya, in an airstrike, a drone strike on a car. Sharif, final comments.
Yeah, I think, look, in this country, the journalistic community should be outraged, should be vocal in their outrage at Israel's killing of their colleagues in Gaza, and we haven't seen that. And let me just end by saying, you know, in 2022, the Pulitzer Board awarded a special citation to journalists of Ukraine for their coverage of the Russian invasion and of the war. And the citation reads, quote, "Despite bombardment, abductions, occupation, and even deaths in their ranks, they have persisted in their effort to provide an accurate picture of a terrible reality," end quote. This is the case many times over for the journalists of Gaza, for the Palestinian journalists of Gaza. I doubt they will be receiving any such accolades, and that's where the problem lies.
Sharif Abdelkaddous, independent journalist, wrote this piece for The Intercept. Israel bombed an Al Jazeera cameraman and blocked evacuation efforts as he bled to death. We'll link to it at The Intercept at democracynow.org. And Sharif Mansour, Committee to Protect Journalists, Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator, speaking to us from D.C. Next up, we look at what Israelis see on television. Stay with us.
قضية وتلك قضية. كيف تكون ملاكا أبيض يبقى ضميرك نص ضمير تنصف حركات الحرية وتنصف حركات التحرير وتوزع عطفك وحنانك عالمقتول حسب الجنسية وتلك قضية وتلك قضية. كيف تكون إنسانا راق ومطابق للاشتراطات
تلك قضية. This is an issue by Kairoki. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. From coverage of the war by Palestinian journalists on the ground, we turn to coverage by the Israeli media. What do most Israelis see on TV? How has the Israeli media's coverage shaped opinions of war? This is a clip from I-24 News of Israeli military commander Lieutenant Colonel Dothan talking about an alleged Hamas tunnel in an exclusive video shown by the network last week.
The IDF has found tunnels and weapons inside a child's room inside the Gaza Strip. These visuals were obtained from the IDF. And I-24 News is now going to be allowed to play that. Let's take a look.
During our patrols in the area, we uncovered the entrance to a tunnel under this children's bedroom, actually under this desk, exactly where the children were supposed to study. We can see very clearly the tunnel which goes towards the tunnel gallery. We can also see here these RPG missiles, these munitions grouped in the same sector, including military tactical vests and grenades ready for use.
That was a clip from Israeli media outlet I-24 News. For more on Israeli media's coverage of the war, we go to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by Gideon Levy, an award-winning Israeli journalist and author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, a member of its editorial board. His most recent piece headlined, "If it isn't a genocide in Gaza, then what is it?" Gideon, welcome back to Democracy Now! talk about what Israelis see on television, where most get their news. We just did this whole piece on the killing of Gazan journalists, Palestinian journalists. We've never seen anything like this anywhere in modern history, where you have between 80 and over 100 Palestinian journalists killed in just a matter of weeks. What do Israelis understand is happening?
The main question, Amy, is what they don't see or what they are not being shown. Because, as you know, and as your viewers definitely know, Israeli media is quite a free media, commercial-owned, quite liberal, no pressure from the government or secret services or army or things like this. Anything it does voluntarily. And the Israeli media decided almost wall-to-wall, maybe except of my newspaper, Haaretz, all the rest. It's not only TV, also newspapers. They decided that they are part of the Israeli propaganda machinery. They stop being journalists. And this they do in two ways. The first one is the most serious one. They don't show Gaza. The Israeli average viewer doesn't see Gaza at all. He sees the soldiers. He sees the families of the hostages. He's being told day and night about the Israeli sacrifice. He's being told day and night how brave are the soldiers. You see it 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and only one thing you don't see, the suffer of Gaza. And the media decided not to show it, not because anyone pushed the media not to do it. They do it because they know very clear that this is what their viewers don't want to see. And they want to please them. And by this, they are betraying our first mission, to tell the full story. You know, there are Israelis who wouldn't care less to see all those terrible images and say, Hamas is to be blamed, the Arabs are to be blamed, they deserve it, they are barbarian, everything is fine. But they have to see what is being done on our behalf. So that's the first level. The second level, which is less important but still must be mentioned, is that Israeli media speaks now only in one voice. There is no room for any critic about the war. There is no room for any question marks. I don't remember a war in which, after so many stages, still the entire media is just a pale echo of the propaganda machinery of the army.
Well, Gideon, your newspaper, Haaretz, is somewhat different from the rest of the press, but how widely read is it within Israel, and who reads Haaretz?
Haaretz is not a big newspaper in terms of quantity, but it is still quite a influential newspaper, both abroad, as you know, because it's being published both in English and in Hebrew. And also in Israel, still parts of the elite are reading it. I don't want to say that every Israeli reads Haaretz, but every Israeli knows about Haaretz. And through the social media, it has some kind of influence, but it is obviously very limited.
Can you talk about the levels in Gaza we're hearing about? Of starvation that every Palestinian is hungry right now. The babies being pulled from the rubble. I mean, we're thousands of miles away from you. Tel Aviv is very close to Gaza. What do they see when it comes to casualties?
Nothing. They hear the figures, but figures are only figures. It's only statistics. It doesn't make you feel, it doesn't make you understand the scale of the tragedy, the scale of the crimes, I must say. You know, you watch all the international networks and you see Gaza. You see the children dying on the dirty floors of the hospitals, bleeding to death. You see the uprooted people, you see the destruction. You see the suffer of hundreds of thousands of people, and obviously the starvation. And in Israel, you see only the soldiers, only the families of the hostages, only the scenes where you don't see Palestinians at all. It seems as if they don't exist. Now, Amy, that's not new, because the Israeli media betrayed its mission by covering in the same way the occupations throughout so many years. It was always dehumanizing the Palestinians as much as possible. But this time we reach a level that I don't remember such a level, because you can really watch for hours Israeli TV and have no clue what's going on in Shifa Hospital or in other hospitals or in uprooted neighborhoods. And where are the people? How do they make their living? Do they get some food? Nothing of this. Nothing which might remind us that the Palestinians are human beings. This is almost a taboo. Don't mention them as human beings.
Gideon, Prime Minister Netanyahu keeps assuring the international community that Israel does not intend to permanently occupy Gaza. But what is he saying domestically to the Israeli people? He even has two Twitter handles, one that's an official one, and then another that is more geared toward sending out incendiary messages to the population.
Just this morning, he was quoted in a private talk, I think, that the war will continue at least until 2025. And nobody sees the end. Nobody knows the end. There is no end game. There is no plan what to do the day after. And Israelis start to believe now that this might last for many years, at least the occupation of Gaza, obviously without intention. Almost everything that Israel did in the last decades was without intention. But it always came out. It never intended to go for wars. And it always finds itself in war. It never intended to create an occupation of over 50 years. And it came out like this. No, no. The intention is one thing and the results are another thing. Israel has no plan to leave Gaza in the coming months or years, which doesn't mean that Israel will stay there. But I don't see any alternative right now. What will they do?
I wanted to ask you about your paper, Haaretz, reporting that a group of family members of Israelis who were killed in Kibbutz Be'eri on October 7th in the Hamas attack on Israel are demanding a probe into how their relatives died. An Israeli brigadier general recently admitted he ordered an Israeli tank commander to fire on a home where Hamas fighters were holding 15 Israeli hostages. Brigadier General Barak Hiram told the New York Times he'd ordered the tank commander to, quote, break in even at the cost of civilian casualties. 13 of the Israeli hostages died. Only two survived. Gideon, you're a member of the Haaretz editorial board, which recently ran a piece headlined, "The IDF must investigate the Kibbutz Be'eri tank fire incident right now." Elaborate on what happened and the investigation your editorial board is calling for now.
Look, everyone is postponing all the investigation to the day after, and the day after seems to get farther and farther, and we are very concerned that it will never be investigated. But here we have a very concrete case, and families, rightly so, want to know who is responsible for the killing of their beloved ones, and how did it happen? The brigadier general that you just mentioned happened to be a settler. I don't want to say that it says a lot, but let's remember that many of our high-ranked generals, or more and more of them, are settlers, and settlers have their own ideology, even when they serve in the army. They have their own motivation, which is not always a very secular motivation. It's not always the motivation of the others. But in any case, the fact is that those people were killed and might have been rescued. It must be investigated. It's not very complicated to investigate it. It's a very concrete and focused event, and we were calling the army to do so. I don't know. Until now, we didn't hear from the army. I hope they will do it, because this can have also a lot of consequences in the coming days or weeks or months in Gaza, because this situation might repeat itself when we will face a house where there are hostages and commanders of Hamas. Do we shoot them all dead? I really wonder.
And you also had a piece on how sexism ultimately killed what are known as the spotters, the Israeli military, the women who were on the border, who were seeing Hamas gear up, were telling their supervisors, it looks like there's about to be an imminent attack. And some were even told if they raise this again, they would be brought up on charge of insubordination. Is that right, Gideon?
Yeah. We had a big story on this. But, you know, the small stories might overwhelm or overshadow the big story. Because the big story, finally, there are two big, huge question marks. A, what happened on the 7th? And how did it happen? Because all those stories get to one conclusion, that there was no army on this day. There was not the most sophisticated intelligence in the world, with all the most sophisticated devices, who knows the color of the underwears of each Palestinian, all of a sudden didn't know anything. After all the money in which was invested there and all the reputation they have. And then came the second question, where was the army after the attack started? No army whatsoever. And above all, the question which bothers me more than anything else, and that's namely, having said what happened on the 7th, as barbaric as it was, whatever it was, there are question marks about certain events on the 7th, but it's very clear that there was an attack, a very aggressive attack. Does this give us Israelis the right to do anything we want after the 7th, forever, without any limits, no legal limits, no moral limits? We can just go and kill and destroy and destruct as much as we wish? That's the main question right now. The event that you mentioned with those soldiers' girls just show how unprepared and unprofessional was the intelligence and the army.
And, of course, most of those young women died. Last question, your biggest piece, if it isn't a genocide
only
in Gaza.
Only two survived. Only two survived, yeah.
Only two. If it isn't a genocide in Gaza, yeah, then what is it? We just have 30 seconds, Gideon.
Listen, the Israelis don't seem to care that so many innocent Palestinians were killed. They just care how to label it, if it's genocide or not. And I say it doesn't matter what is the legal definition. 24,000 people, most of them innocent people, 60-70% of them women and children, 10,000 children among them. This is enough of a fact that nobody can deny, by the way, to ask ourselves, do we really have the right to do it? What does it tell about us, about our moral standards? And above all, how long will we go on and where are we aiming to? Another 25,000 killed people in Gaza will guarantee more security to Israel? And even if yes, do we have the right to do so?
Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist, author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, also a member of the Haaretz editorial board. We'll link to your piece. If it isn't a genocide in Gaza, then what is it? Next up, from Iraq to Lebanon to Pakistan to the Red Sea, will Israel's war on Gaza escalate into a full-blown regional conflict? Back in 20 seconds.
You won't be silenced, no, the noise came from here. A never-ending war will not be waged from here. The future is my home, it all came from here. Police and sirens, guns are on parade right here. You never touch my love.
The noise came from here by Saul Williams. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. From northern Iraq to Lebanon to Pakistan to the Red Sea, an array of strikes and counterstrikes over the last several days are compounding fears that Israel's assault on Gaza could escalate into a full-blown regional war. In just the past few days, the U.S. has carried out strikes against Houthi rebels in Yemen, who have resumed their attacks on container ships in the Red Sea. Iran has struck what it said was an Israeli spy headquarters in the semi-autonomous Kurdish region of northern Iraq, as well as targeting anti-Iran militants in Pakistan and Syria. Meanwhile, in Lebanon, Hezbollah and Israel have escalated the intensity of fighting across the border. For more, we're joined by award-winning journalist Spencer Ackerman, foreign policy columnist for The Nation magazine. His latest piece, Israel's Not Promising to Scale Back Its War. He also publishes the Forever Wars newsletter on Ghost, where his new piece is headlined Iran's Opening Shots and the Logic of Escalation. Welcome back, Spencer, to Democracy Now! Talk about this possibility of a widening war and what you are most concerned about.
Amy, thank you for having me. I think that in my 20-plus years of covering the war on terror, this is the most dangerous moment in for the Middle East that I've seen professionally. You talk about there being the possibility of a full-blown regional conflict. We're at least at half-blown now. Consider what the battlefields are and have been in this conflict. Gaza, obviously the most important one, the most devastating to humanity, where the Palestinians are experiencing what could and probably should be understood as a genocide. But also southern Israel, northern Israel, southern Lebanon, northwestern Syria, Beirut, northeastern Syria, Erbil, Baghdad, southwestern Yemen, the Red Sea, Pakistan as well. This is now a conflict with battlefronts ranging across the region, each of which facing pressure to escalate as their various combatants' objectives are not fully achieved. We shouldn't think that absent an active act of de-escalation, that this won't continue spiraling outward throughout 2024.
And Spencer, this whole idea that we hear almost every day some member of the Biden administration say that they're trying to prevent an escalation of the conflict in the region, when in fact their actions are quite the opposite.
That's right, Juan. We heard the Biden administration say most recently that it was deeply concerned about escalation in Lebanon. Well, just in the last 24 hours, the Israeli Air Force has been bombing southern Lebanon, bombing what it says are Hezbollah positions there. But also the United States has taken direct action, not just in the Red Sea, but also on Yemeni soil itself. Multiple times, three times at least, including most recently yesterday. And as well, recently, it carried out its first drone strike in Baghdad since 2020, which has now strained U.S.-Iraqi relations. So the United States, while it might say that it's seeking to contain the conflict, is caught up in the logic of escalation. And that means we shouldn't give the Biden administration a pass on this. These aren't, you know, automatic gravitational forces. These are the accumulations of choices that Biden and his team are making to involve the U.S. more deeply in this spiraling conflict, all of which could be stopped if the United States used its immense influence over Israel to restrain it or stop it from carrying out its collective punishment of Gaza.
We often hear as well about the axis of resistance supposedly controlled or financed by Iran, but very little about the axis of empire of the UK, the United States, and Israel in the region. To what degree does this axis have more right to control the affairs of the region than those who are actually from countries there?
Quite well said, Juan. Without ceding any of Iran's claims to regional hegemony, the United States and its allies act as if they are the representatives of the natural and just order of the Middle East and not, in fact, Western impositions upon the aspirations of the citizenry, the people of these countries, to determine their own affairs. And we are seeing that quite starkly most recently in Yemen, where one of the most war-devastated countries in the Middle East, as a result of not only U.S. strikes against al-Qaeda targets, what the United States says is al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, stemming from something like 15 over the past 15 years, but also a U.S.-backed Saudi and Emirati campaign that lasted 7 years before a ceasefire took hold in 2022 that brought not only famine, but cholera to this country that has been engulfed in a foreign-backed, foreign-sponsored, and foreign-accelerated civil war. Nevertheless, even among people who don't accept the Houthi movement as the legitimate rulers of Yemen, saw massive demonstrations after the United States and its Western allies started bombing Yemen in retaliation for the Houthi attempt to relieve the siege of Gaza. So you really have you really have on full exposure the rejection of U.S. claims to, you know, standing for peace and stability in the region.
Spencer, your piece last week for The Nation is headlined, "Israel's Not Promising to Scale Back Its War," which you wrote partly as a corrective to a New York Times article that claimed that's what Israel is planning. If you could explain this and what it means for—I mean, we just heard Gideon Levy, the Israeli Jewish journalist at Haaretz, talking about this war going on for a year or more.
That's right. Amy, when you listen to what the Israeli government says to its own people, like Gideon mentioned, it talks about a war that will—and this is what Benjamin Netanyahu said over the weekend—will last until victory and no one, not even The Hague, will stop us, which is an incredibly ominous thing to say and probably ought to be tacked on to South Africa's genocide lawsuit. What it says to the Americans, as the Americans are feeling the pressure from its Arab allies in the region, and indeed from President Biden's own supporters in the United States who want to see this war stop, is that, in fact, it's scaling down to lower intensity operations. Or more often, it doesn't say that quite outright. It says it will move away from high intensity operations into what it says is a so-called phase three of its operations in Gaza. So what is phase three? Phase three focuses on southern Gaza. Every day, we are getting reports of casualties from Gaza, civilian casualties in the triple digits. Israel already made something like 1.7, 1.8 million people relocate to southern Gaza. So this war is not, in fact, scaling down. It's moving toward a sustainable path of civilian devastation.
Spencer Ackerman, foreign policy columnist for The Nation magazine, will also publishes the Forever Wars on newsletter on Ghost. We'll link to your pieces at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
This is An Experiment with Time on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.